Hi, Eve.
Hi.
It's great to have you on Blocking Heads for the first time. And people know me, I'm Ann Altas of the University of Wisconsin Law School and the blog Altas. But tell Blogging Heads audience about yourself.
I'm a freelance journalist. I write for a number of different publications, Commonweal, the Weekly Standard. I mostly do art and book and theater reviews, and some writing on marriage and family life. I have a more or less monthly column at Inside Catholic online.
And just to be clear for people who are just on the audio and aren't seeing your name, you can
Oh,
say
I'm
your full
sorry.
name.
Eve Tushnet.
Okay, so you're Eve Tushnet, and some people know you from an article that was written about you in the New York Times this past week. Were you happy? It's kind of weird, and it happened to me once when the New York Times decides they want to write an article about you, that there's something interesting about you as a character that fits with whatever their New York Times agendas are, the kind of set of things that they like to focus on for one reason or another. And I got into that zone once a year or so ago. Why do you think they wrote this about you, and are you happy with the way they presented it? The article was called A Gay Catholic Voice Against Same-Sex Marriage.
I assume that there's, a sort of novelty or freak of the week aspect to their interest, but I actually was basically happy with the article. It was a little more happy-go-lucky than I think I really am in real life. I come across as something of a Pollyanna, but and also,
You
Mark
wanted a
Ivanov.
grimmer portrait, is that what you're saying? You think?
And Mark Oppenheimer, who did the piece, obviously didn't choose the headline. I would have preferred something that didn't frame everything around sort of the policy issues, which are not my main interest. The things that I'm most excited about are really ways of sort of expanding the possibilities for gay Catholics and finding ways of talking about what our vocation could be in the church.
So you're not
But
particularly
it got into
interested
that.
in legislation or law with respect to same-sex marriage.
No, I mean, I have opinions about it, right? And I do work on that. But it's in terms of sort of where my heart is. But I thought it was a very flattering article. So
Yeah, it was
that was
nice.
good.
Nice. A nice little picture, too, where they have you, I guess, reflected in some mirrored glass and making a double image of you. I thought that was kind of artsy, but possibly symbolic. Did you think that
Yeah.
that meant anything? The picture, which was by
I didn't
Lou
understand the picture. People were
Gutsch.
trying, I've read people online trying to sort of parse this picture, and I have no idea.
Well, like you're back to back with yourself, like you're Janus-faced or something. But of course, no one uses a computer like that, a laptop holding it up with one hand and then
Well, they
typing
tried
with
to
your
get
other
a
hand.
bunch of shots of me actually sitting and typing, and I guess those turned out badly. I'm sorry, there's a siren going by here.
It's okay. Yeah, I think that photographers who are doing these portraits for articles in newspapers have this problem now where everybody works at a computer and just endless pictures of people at the computer. How can you make them interesting? So I think they did a nice job on that, but I thought maybe they were trying to get some symbolism into that as far as creating a double image of you. But it is interesting. I thought that one of the reasons they were interested in you was that you came from a kind of a left wing or progressive background, and then you went into the conservative and religious mode after coming from I think, a non-religious background and a progressive background. You went to Yale and you turned conservative and you went Catholic. I think that that's and of course they've got you in the beliefs section. So clearly, I think that that's a part of what they were focusing on. Could you talk about that a little?
I wouldn't say non-religious in terms of background. It was sort of intermittently religious. I did go to a Jewish day camp and had some limited degree of contact with Jewish religious life. And a lot of that has actually, a lot of my upbringing has really stuck with me. Mm-hmm. I know that it looks as if there's been this sort of 180 degree, I don't know math, turnaround, but yeah. But that's really not entirely true. I think there are ways in which my upbringing specifically did prepare me for encountering the Catholic Church. One thing that I think about a lot and speculate on, I've never heard other people talking about this, mm-hmm. so I'd be sort of interested, is whether the kind of contemporary left-wing Jewish emphasis on justice and the mm-hmm. concept of justice was actually really useful in preparing me for Christianity, really. Because if you have such an intense, I think one thing that people often aren't convinced of in America is their own kind of inadequacy or inability to fulfill. There are things that you can't do that you know that you need to. And if you have, if you're raised in this somewhat utopian but very strongly centered on a vision of the good, mm-hmm. which my upbringing really was, then you're very aware, I think, of the ways in which you're not instantiating justice in your own life, and the ways in which if justice were to be enacted, you would probably be on the receiving end of some very, you know, sharp justice. And so I think
I was just going to say, so this connects to a Christian idea that has more to do with forgiveness.
Yeah, exactly.
That you can't possibly live up to all the requirements of the law. And so if you've really been been formed thinking a lot about justice and law, that the move from the Old Testament to the New Testament is a natural one, or it feels normal rather than a rejection. It feels like a fulfillment.
Yeah, and also, you know, the sort of tragedies and disappointments of the utopian way of thinking, I think, sort of prepare you for the crucifixion, really, of something really catastrophic has got to happen if the world as we see it now can be redeemed. So I think in that way there was a very natural progression from the specific kind of left-wing Jewish milieu in which I was raised. But as I said, I've never heard other people say this, so maybe this is just a quirk of my personality.
So when they profile you in the New York Times, they make it seem like it's a quirk of your personality or it's about a personal life. Well, I guess I think a lot of people who maybe go into journalism also interested in literature and novels, mm-hmm. and so on. So there's a lot of focus on the emotional structure of the person,
right.
and so forth, rather than these external, well, I know you study philosophy, but these ex- uh-huh. and law, I know, and I'm just bringing in law, but uh-huh. the idea that there are these sort of abstract external structures that we could think about in a neutral, an abstract way. I think when they write profiles like this, they're naturally going to gravitate toward the sort of personal story of a person's emotional development. And you brought that in too. It sounds like you're wondering whether it's a personal emotional story for you, or you're really thinking in abstract, broad terms that would apply to everyone.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would really make that distinction, just insofar as anytime you're doing philosophy, if you're doing it well, right, you are engaged with it entirely. Like, you have to do some degree of sort of personal emotional work on the front end before you're even at the point of being able to engage in rational discourse. Mm-hmm. And that discourse is going to have to happen within, or ideally happen within, a sort of emotional matrix of friendship and relationship. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I guess, I mean, yeah, I definitely agree with you. I would like to see journalists who evidence more training in philosophy, uh-huh. but because I think they would have a broader sense then of what counts as human interests, what counts as the real story, the real human story, which is often yeah. about people trying to work out intellectual issues as best they can. People yeah. do this thinking all the time, like not just academics, everyone, right, you know, is confronted with these major existential questions. And despite what we are constantly told, you know, sometimes people think about them and don't just sort of feel them. And I would love to see more acknowledgement of that, yeah. you know, the guy sitting on the bus next to you might be going through some pretty tough philosophical thinking.
Well, I missed the first part of that sentence. Could you?
Oh, sorry. Just, you know, that anyone, you know, you walk past someone on the street or what have you, could be really wrestling with major existential philosophical questions in ways that are about more about their emotions and prompted by their emotions, but that also involve their reason.
Yeah. I mean, I know that when I hear people talk about their politics, for example, I've had some run-ins with libertarians and I always think that there's you know, people who support conservative or liberal politics, that I always think that there's something emotionally that's drawing them in the direction that they're going. And they want to talk about how it's abstract reason. And I just, I've just read too many judicial opinions to not to think that there's something more than the way they're portraying it in terms of reason, and that there is emotion interwoven with reason that's got to be there. It's got to be pulling them in one direction or another. But a lot of times people don't want to talk about that at all. And some people will get quite angry if you ask them to talk about their political or other philosophical positions in terms of their personal emotions. But, I mean, from what I've read about the brain, just from a scientific standpoint, I think that reason and emotion are interwoven in a completely mysterious way that has to be acknowledged. So I just never believe people when they won't bring the personal into it. Although I think there's some people that don't want to talk about reason at all, and everything is emotional, especially in newspaper articles. I do think that everything is about the person.
Right. Well, and, you know, I resist motive guessing. I mean, I think regardless of which emotional things are playing a role, if it's team loyalty, if it's I like being quirky, whatever, if it's I feel the need. I, for example, one thing that people always talk about with conservatism, right, is people who themselves are either extremely responsible or extremely irresponsible tend to gravitate toward conservatism because it either rewards them for doing what they're supposed to do, or it kind of corrals them. And I think that's fair. But at the same time, right, the ideas should be open to engagement. Engagement, that can't be the right word, but you know what I mean. It should be possible for people who don't have those emotional
I like the word engage for that. I often use it in teaching in law school. Like, just want you to engage with the subject, you know, just to, you know, really talk about it in some deeper way.
And but that was very much...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that that was very much my experience in college, that people from really different family dynamics, really different personalities, could actually, you know, engage with one another's arguments, and that changes your emotional profile as well.
So. Now, you had a very strong experience with this right-wing, is it fair to call them right-wing group on campus?
Yes.
The Party of Right. Yes. And according to the New York Times article that you when you were a student at Yale, you went to the Party of the Right, that you went to one of their meetings, quote, specifically to laugh at them, to see the zoo animals. So tell us a little bit about that. Obviously, they made a big impression on you at that point, and you were won over in some way. So there was a real emotional transformation, you know, that when you encountered, you know, this collision of past and this people coming from a completely different place, had a very profound impact on you. And obviously, I think a lot of people who have these student groups at universities are just hoping for things like that to happen. Or I guess that's part of the idea of the university, you know, the diversity of the university. People send their children into that, or the faculty supports an environment like that. I don't think they're always thinking that the progressive students will become conservative, but it's kind of the university ideal that you would meet something that was quite different, and somehow it would be transformative.
Yeah, and I think a lot of things went into that. One, that it's a very small community. I don't think that the university as a whole can really foster that the sort of intensity of philosophical and personal transformation that a small group can. And in fact, it probably helps to have the university against you a little bit, which was certainly true for us. Largely our fault. And also that... this may be overgeneralizing, but my impression was that at least while I was there, Yale still had a very strong ethos of seeking to create leaders. And that was a big part, I think, of why the Party of the Right talked the way that it did and flourished there. But, I mean...
Mm-hmm. So I they fit with this university ideal of producing leaders, even though they were at the opposite end of the political spectrum.
Right.
They really did fit into this sort of ideal of leadership. But right, now, what was it? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was really struck when I was a freshman by this one op-ed in the Yale Daily News, which was talking about how the Yale man needs to be an environmentalist and conserve the environment. And to me, it was like, you know, like, that's fine. What, I have no beef with the environment, right? But it was very striking to me that people still talked in terms of creating the Yale man, even though this author clearly meant, you know, and women as well.
Wow, what year was that?
That would have been when I was a freshman in 96, 97.
Wow. Because I feel like here at the University of Wisconsin, even in the mid-80s, the idea of not really carefully always including women, even to say he and she, he or she, you know, would be necessary. But actually to say the Yale man, other than a pronoun, to say
man, sure
that would
some
really
I'm sure at some point the author threw in, you know, and the Yale woman, but the overwhelming sort of rhetorical trick that he was using, right, required him to say the Yale man.
Now, but tell us particularly about why they didn't turn these people you thought would be ridiculous seemed non-ridiculous to you and, in fact, very profound and meaningful to you. How did I think there are a lot of conservatives who would love to win over progressives. So what's the trick?
I think the three main weapons, surprise. I think the three things that were the most striking were one, that people really made it evident without being self-pitying or whiny that they made choices which would make their lives more difficult because they thought it was the right thing to do. It is very easy to paint both conservatives and libertarians as kind of people who defend things that are fun for them and make their lives easier, defend their own privileges or what have you. You know, I'm a libertarian because I like money and I want to smoke pot.
But a lot of lefties talk in those terms, too, about the importance of sacrifice. I remember back after 9/11, there was a lot of talk about how Bush was not calling on Americans to make sacrifices and that was important.
Right. And I guess I don't even mean so much using the rhetoric of sacrifice as more just it's very striking when you find someone who says, you know, I'm now trying to remember what the particular examples were, but even something as minor as, you know, I switched into the philosophy major, even though I am really worried about how I'll support my family after college, because I think that this is where I'm going to find truth, and that's the most important thing to me.
So people who were dedicated
even something like that.
To truth above everything else. So do you think it's more in the conservative line of thinking to be dedicated to truth above all else, and on the left it's more about being dedicated to the welfare of other people?
I mean, I wouldn't put it quite that strongly. There are lots and lots of varieties of conservatism and leftism. There's certainly forms of leftism which are more or less skeptical of objective truth and sort of the philosophical project. It's more just if you're asking about sort of what makes the conservative intellectual project credible, I think being willing to take a hit for the team is a big part. And especially because Americans right now, for reasons mostly bad, I think, are obsessed with hypocrisy. And I certainly was as a freshman. I was very aware that these people who talked in these high rhetorical terms about justice and, you know, doing the right thing, you know, one of my big sort of emotional journeys of freshman year was wondering if they were all just, you know, BSing. And finding out the degree to, like, a little bit they were, but finding out the degree to which they were absolutely willing to stand behind their beliefs was very important for me. And I think that that's a real concern that people, again, for reasons that are good and bad, but mostly bad, have about conservatism as an intellectual movement. Is it just an excuse? Is it something that you tell other people to do and then you go off and live your decadent, you know, postmodern late capitalist life?
Now, tie that to religion, because this also led you into embracing the Catholic religion, including or maybe even in particular being drawn to the idea of making a sacrifice. That's something that you wanted to do, would be something that you couldn't do, that you would, you know, be called to a higher morality that would require sacrifices, and nobody else in your life was even asking or expecting or thinking it would even be good for you to make.
Let me think how to put this. I think the best way to articulate the role that sort of the church's theology of sacrifice played in my conversion is more like I would mistrust any religion or philosophy that did not require some sacrifice from me. So it's not so much that I was attracted to the specific ones in the Catholic Church, very much not, but more like the fact that they were willing to be hardcore and demanding was in itself a sign that there was probably something real there. One of the things that I think this debating society that I was in, the Party of the Right, is very clear on is that every freshman who comes to Yale, no matter what they believe, is inadequate in some way. And if they're not seeking to really sort of transform themselves, then they should be. And I felt that very keenly. I was very aware that what I had coming in was insufficient. And so, again, if I had merely run across a religion that sort of affirmed me in my okayness and said, you know, you're doing pretty well, keep up the good work, I just don't think I would have trusted that.
It seems to me some religions call on you to do things that, if you're not religious, it doesn't seem to be any reason at all to do them, like not to eat pork or to wear a hat and things like that. There's no reason why, if you didn't think God wanted you to do it, there would be no reason to do it. There would be no reason to limit yourself that way. And that seems to be a large part of the point, that you're now doing something purely because it's required, not because there's any inherent good in it. But I take it that thinking that you need to be chaste, to abstain from sex your whole life, that's different from I can never eat pork, which seems to be something that you only do because it's required. It would seem to me that you're seeing some good in it that you would see even if it were not a requirement of religion.
Oh, I don't think I would say that. I do see a lot of good in in the way that I live my life, in terms of celibacy, chastity. But it is if I were not Catholic, I am quite sure that I would be, you know, looking for a nice young lady to settle down with.
So you in no way think that celibacy is a good way of life for people outside of religion. I mean, this was one of my big questions for you. Is there some positive value of celibacy that can be understood apart from any idea that there's a requirement imposed authoritatively on you?
There certainly can be for some people, I'm sure. I just don't really understand it very well. I know that there are people who find that it allows them, women especially, I think, find that being unmarried and not tied down in that way helps them to focus on their artistic vocation. Emily Dickinson would probably be an obvious example here.
I think a lot of women go through periods in their life when they prefer celibacy to being with someone mm-hmm. else. I mean, I sort of have been in periods of my life where I had the personal motto, better than nothing is a high standard, so that there was like conceivably a relationship that you could have and a married
right.
man. But it should be a very high standard to actually be in a sexual relationship with someone, and that the default position should be celibacy. And that people don't understand that very well, or celibacy isn't I don't want to say promoted, but isn't understood and valued and seen as an inherent good in our culture, at least. But I'm trying to say that aside from feeling that it's a religious mm-hmm, requirement
right.
outside of marriage. And I assume that your religious requirement position would apply to everyone that isn't married.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, for me personally, as I said, I don't really understand the sort of personal choice of celibacy very well. It's easier for me to understand as something where it's more like, look, this is, you know, this is a part of your vocation. This is what you have to do. So make it work. Make it fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
That's easier for me to grasp. I agree that it is not especially valued in contemporary society for a couple. I actually remember a friend of mine who at one point was considering the priesthood. He's now married. But when he was very serious about potentially becoming a priest, people would literally say to him, but that means you never get to have sex again and your head will explode. It was just, there was no
yeah.
comprehension whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think some of that is related to one of my sort of pet topics or hobby horses, which is the degree to which we've narrowed the idea of which relationships are important and which relations can be publicly acknowledged as important.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's pretty much only your sexual partners and maybe your parents
mm-hmm.
And children.
Yeah.
But other stuff, like, you know, friendship is no longer a public category.
Yeah.
And I think that's tragic.
Yeah, I know that you've written on the subject of friendship in connection with religion, and I assume beyond that people don't value their friends enough. They will abandon their friends for their sexual partners. They will put their children and anything having to do with the family above their friends. And friends seem to be a poor substitute for the relationships you're really supposed to have. So it would be great if there were a revival of the great valuing of a friendship. I mean, I wish there was more friendship. So you feel we're friendship impoverished and that there's something that can be done about that?
I think that there's a lot that could be done. It ranges from everything, even just little things like, you know, what do parents ask their children about when they see them? You know, do they ask after the friends that they know the child is close to? Do they assume that that's sort of a normal thing to kind of check up on? To much broader things, both the Eastern and Western churches used to have rituals for acknowledging and binding friends together publicly. Some of the Eastern churches apparently still do this, which is kind of fascinating. I would love to see that revived, and that would require a pretty broad change and more willingness to experiment and less fear of change than I think is present in at least the Western church right now, which is sad.
That sounds a little related to being pro-same-sex marriage, the idea that there was a church tradition where friends were bound together. Why wouldn't you go from that idea into being in favor of same-sex marriage? Or do you accept the authoritarian quality of the Catholic Church, where if the church says it, that's just the answer, and there's no role for you to question that?
Well, with something that I think both scripture and tradition are as consistent and clear on as same-sex sex, yeah, right. I don't think there's a way around the church's authority on that. But, you know, if you look at these friendship vows and rituals, they have some similarities to marriage rituals, but they're their own sort of unique thing, which is pretty much, you know, leaving aside the religion and sex angle, it is pretty much how I see gay relationships anyway, as having many features in common with marriage, but having many features which are their own unique thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, I see the parallel that you're drawing, but if you sort of dig down into what was expected of friends in these vows, you'll start to see that the differences are important as well as the similarities. One of the forms of language used to describe people in these relationships was wedded brothers, which I think gives you a sense of how people were sort of struggling to articulate the ways in which this relationship sort of fit into the other kinship patterns that they were used to.
It sounds to me like it might have also something to do with just not valuing women sufficiently, so that women were off on the side and you had to be married to them so that you could have your sexual fulfillment, you could have your families, your real relationship were the valued relationship was men with men, because, you know, that was the world of the life of the mind, the life of commerce, everything that mattered other than the family, which was over there attended to by the women. I'm afraid that there might be a connection to the subordination of women in that idea.
I think in some cultural moments that was probably true. My impression, which is an amateur's impression, is that that was not universally true. And in fact, some of these rituals have on occasion been performed with women as well, mm-hmm. although, again, my amateur impression is that that is rarer.
Now, you haven't considered becoming a nun, have you?
No. No, I am pretty
clear that gets the women together
have,
in a vow, uh-huh. and then they're committed in a relationship, right? That would have the kind of a same-sex but celibate vowed relationship to the it's not one-on-one, but that's not you would reject that, I assume, or would
I?
Want to be a nun anymore, or I don't know, I'm not Catholic, I don't.
Right, well, partly, you know, I said this, I wrote a review for First Things of a book on Catholic feminism, and one of the things that I opened with was I have personally never met a nun in my entire life. That says a lot about how the church has changed in the past half century or so.
Yeah. And you can't tell. They don't wear the cool clothes anymore.
Right. But I think anyone who knows me will say that taking a vow of obedience, while it might be good for me, is not something I'm going to do unless you make me.
But that friendship ceremony was about making a commitment, or wasn't it? Or did you have to get a
yes.
divorce to get out of it, or is there no way out, or your friends for life?
I don't even recall anyone talking about, in what I've read, anyone talking about these vows ending in any way other than the death of one of the participants. Hmm.
Now, I wanted to ask you about what you thought of Andrew Sullivan, because whole idea of accepting the authority of the church and mm-hmm. and you know, if you're going to join the church, then you accept it as an authoritarian structure, and then it's your challenge to live up to all of those requirements. And if they say no gay sex, no gay sex, you don't make mm-hmm. arguments for why it would be a preferable interpretation, and that Catholicism should change, that's not part of what you would do, which obviously, and same-sex marriage, all of those are things that I would associate Andrew Sullivan above everyone else with. And so I wonder what you think of his writings, or how he performs being a Catholic in the public world.
I think a lot of his writing about what it is like to be gay and Catholic is very powerful. And also, I said this on the blog, I think yesterday, he mentioned his essay on friendship, which is the third part of Love Undetectable.
Mm-hmm.
That is, to my mind, by far the best thing he's ever written. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend that to everyone. But, you know, it's impossible for me to enter into what it's like to grow up in the Catholic Church. And so I don't know.
So the converts are different. You accept everything right. as an adult, whereas if you're brought up in it, the question is, do you have to leave? And you feel like, well, this is
right.
mine. I don't want to have to give
right.
it up. It's a different relationship
right.
if you've been a convert.
Right. I mean, you know, I had to like stand up in front of lots of people and say when I was baptized, I believe all that the Catholic Church believes and teaches. And it took me, you know, some hard thinking to get to the point that I could say that honestly. And that's not an experience in quite the same way that you'll have if you were baptized as an infant and grew up in this belief system.
We might go through confirmation, but I guess the Catholic would do it at a very early age. Mm-hmm. Too early to really have genuinely accepted it, I would think. But but this whole idea of interpretation and looking at religion or looking at philosophical questions with somewhere in your thinking, there's this desire to have it come out the way you want. Obviously, this is a big issue in law. People tend to think if they've, and it's hard not to think it if you've read enough cases that, you know, the judges are, have preferred outcomes and they're pretty much trying to get to them. Right. But there's still this idea that, well, you're not really supposed to do that. And you are always either denying you're doing that or you're making up a new theory of interpretation whereby you actually do kind of get to do that. And that's something that's talked about in law a lot. It seems to be a big component of, religion, but, I would assume that you would take the sort of view that conservatives take in law that you don't get to do that. And the way you want it to come out should be excluded. And you're doing it right when you're not taking account of what you want.
Yeah, I don't know how strongly I could push that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hold on. My computer is doing something very strange.
Uh-oh.
Sorry. Okay, I'm back.
Okay.
I don't know how strongly you can push that because people's underlying, even definitions of things like equality, right, are going to be shaped by their prior philosophical and if they're religious commitments.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, in general, in law, I think, the law is both more honest and legitimate and certainly more available to the ordinary citizens if judges are attempting to avoid outcome-based judging when they can.
Mm-hmm. They certainly feel compelled to claim that they're doing that, and they won't they won't get very far if they don't do that. There seems to be a shared understanding that they're supposed to be doing that, even as there's a shared sense that they do allow their preferences to influence them.
Right.
And there are some fancy theories in law, and I presume in religion, according to which you justify including these preferences. I mean, I think there's a little bit of that in what Barack Obama characterizes as empathy. You know, he's looking for a justice with empathy.
Right.
In other words, there's something about your background, there's something about your feelings, there's something running through you as a human being that's going to pull your decision-making along, and that's what we want. That's a good thing. But I think it was interesting when Sonia Sotomayor went up for confirmation last summer, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with Elena Kagan this year, that when they sat before the American public and gave their answers to the questions that were asked of them by the Senate Judiciary Committee, that they did not at all try to explain a theory of interpretation in those terms, and that, Sonia Sotomayor didn't do it. She acted as if that was some crazy idea the president had, but of course she wouldn't do that. She would do it in the way that you hear conservatives defending it. So it seems that it's not accepted or that it's not worth the risk to portray yourself as doing anything other than that.
Right. Well, I mean, the confirmation hearings at this point are, I can't even say a joke. I mean, they're just sad, sad, gross, pathetic. It's an excuse. It's people sitting there and saying the things that they know that they have to say, and everyone knows that they're saying it because they have to say it. And I don't see how you can believe a single word that comes out of anyone's mouth, you know, right or left. It doesn't even matter.
It's a ritual.
Yeah, it's hazing.
It might as well be like the baptism you described, where you know, do you believe this? You believe, and you say yes to all of that, and you're not. But when you're baptized, of course, if anyone thought you were lying, if you were saying yes to something, you don't really believe all of it. That would be quite awful. But just the things that are framed as the appropriate questions now are very very much against all the kind of liberal interpretation that has been developed in law schools over decades. And
well,
I think it's
totally
quite interesting
sure.
That Obama tried to shift away from that and bring some injection of liberal interpretive philosophy into it, and that Sotomayor didn't try to explain that, didn't try to identify herself with that at all.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's basically everyone in these things is speaking out of both sides of their mouths, because on the other end, you have these conservative senators saying, oh, we just want someone who reads the rules and goes by the rules and is just a referee or whatever it is that John Roberts said.
Umpire.
And yet at the same time, an umpire, that's right. I'm not a sports person.
Umpires are big this week because there was a pitcher in baseball that pitched up what would have been a perfect game, but then the umpire made the wrong call and later admitted that he made the wrong call. But the way baseball is, it stood, so it wasn't a perfect game, and it was a wrong call, and everyone knows it. So the image of umpires maybe is a little tarnished now, because umpires is about, well, somebody has the power to make the call, and that's the way we do it. And even when it's wrong, even when we know it's wrong, it's a little off. So anyway, umpires are a little tarnished these days.
But the thing I was going for was really more like, you know, Senator Kyle or whoever can say that that's what he wants. But in fact, if, you know, the things that I think most people on the right care about do include outcomes. If you come up with some super cool originalist or textualist theory that ends up, you know, legitimizing partial birth abortion, I think many people, you know, on the right would look at you askance.
And
that's an outcome measure.
Yeah, and it may be that, you know, you're for the strict, so-called strict interpretation because you've already seen the way it's more convenient for getting to the outcomes you want, and also it's very useful to be able to posture that you're doing that, and that's why you're doing it. I mean, you could say the same thing about the religions of people pick, that they act like they're doing what's required by their religion, but they have that as their religion because that's what they want to say they're required to do, and be able to point to religion to look particularly lustrous doing it.
I don't know. I mean, I see the parallel that you're drawing in general between religion and the law, but I do think that the issues involved are pretty different. In terms of, for example, you know, you had brought up sort of what you might call outcome-based theology. You know what the answer has to be, and you have to figure out how to get there. And that I actually think can be very intellectually fruitful. If you know that, for example, you cannot come up with the outcome, you know, therefore yay for torture, then you have to do some hard thinking about what the human body means, what it's acceptable to do to a person. In some ways, you know, in some ways it can make you avoid easy paths in theology. And I think you see this with, for example, some of the scholastics. You can see, like, St. Anselm, who I really like, you can see him take, he's been given this story of the crucifixion. And he has to figure out what that means about the nature of justice and mercy. And because he can't get away from it, like, the crucifixion has to stand at the center of his thinking and is totally inescapable, he ends up saying some very profound stuff about the abstract topics that he's working with. So I'm going to defend, you know, outcome-based theology much more strongly than I would outcome-based judging. And maybe also make the point that there are a lot of areas where the church has not spoken with such obvious authority that outcome-based theology is even necessary. If you, like, one of the things that I've blogged about a bit is transgendered issues, and that's something where the church, I think, is much more kind of up in the air than people realize.
So, and I think I read this, if I read your writing correctly, you think it's more consistent with Catholic theology for a person to have a sex change, reassignment surgery, than for a gay person to have sex at all.
Yes.
That seems to be a really strong position.
Yeah, and right, and, you know, I am open to revising my beliefs. But if you sort of the sort of basic argument, right, is that our biology is not solely in big obvious parts of us like our arms or our genitals, but is also expressed in the balance of our hormones, the structure of our brains, other things where like those are also the flesh. And if there's a conflict between the various parts of your flesh, it makes more sense to think of yourself as intersexed and to seek sort of reconstructive surgery based on that. I think that's, at this point, I think that's a position that an Orthodox faithful Catholic can take.
But then why couldn't you also, if you have, if your sexual feelings are directed at a person, people of the same sex, why isn't that a natural and good part of you that can be expressed through physical love? Why would that be excluded? It seems like getting surgery is such a dramatic, extreme thing to do compared with just accepting your genuinely loving feelings toward other people.
Well, there's I think there are a few different issues bound up there. One is just that, you know, there are things which are appropriate for a man to do or for a woman to do that cannot be switched. I think the basic importance of sex difference is pretty crucial to Catholic thought. Beyond that, you know, this is going to sound fairly boring, right? But the church does not tell you not to love people. It guides how you express that. That's true for everyone, but sort of very sharply noticeable for gay people.
But isn't that if sex is this great sort of creative force that is connected with the universe in some profound way, that it has to be about procreation, and if you get sex reassignment surgery, you're not going to produce a child. I mean, you're not really becoming a member of the opposite sex in this sort of higher universal sense that I would think was at the root of the religious idea. If you don't have that, then I don't understand why homosexual sex isn't acceptable. You're not getting into the ability to produce a child.
Well, I actually think while procreation is obviously very important for Catholics, I actually think that it can be somewhat overstated as the basis for Catholic sexual morality. One of the things that I really like about John Paul II's theology of the body is that because he's focusing on the relationship between Adam and Eve in Eden, he's actually focusing on a childless couple. They don't have children until after the fall. So he's focusing on what is unique about the relationship between men and women, even taking procreation and childbearing kind of out of the equation. And that, I think, is sort of, that's both more humane in that it, you know, includes childless couples today. And also, you know, whereas a lot of the sort of procreation heavy talk can seem like it's, you know, excluding people who for whatever reason don't have children. And also I think just more true that sex difference is basic. The primary difference between people.
But obviously, homosexual orientation is part of human life. It's really there, and it's not inherently harmful in any way, other than that it takes you out of the baby-making practice. You're not going to get pregnant that way. So if it's really about the physical need that Adam has for Eve or something like that, I just don't see why gay people aren't included in that, why it's so important to require abstention. And you're recommending that all homosexual persons abstain from all sex. That's the position. But you're only recommending it within Catholicism or for yourself. You're not really proselytizing on that, are you?
Right. I mean, basically, because I don't understand the arguments very well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really hear you. I hear what you're saying. And I go back and forth on the degree to which I feel like I even understand, even from within Catholic theology, where the sort of ban on gay sex, if you will, is coming from. And so, you know, it's just there, I cannot think of a circumstance under which I would start a conversation with someone who was not Catholic and not interested in the Catholic Church. And I would try to, I can't think of a situation in which the thing I would want to do with that person is persuade them not to have sex.
Yeah.
If they're gay. I can see it if they're straight, because that has a lot of consequences.
Yeah. I would sort of encourage everyone to refrain from having sex unless there's real love,
mm-hmm.
and that sure. sex is yeah. over-promoted and it's made too important in the non-loving situation. But that love should really be central, and that's to me yeah. that's an easy proposition to defend both in and out of religion.
Yeah, and I think if you one thing that I would like to see conversations, and I don't know that I have seen this ever, is secular conversations about what constitutes lust. Which ways of looking at and sexually desiring another person are problematic. Because I think everyone, you know, virtually everyone, mm-hmm. no matter how atheist you are, does actually have some belief that there is something which they probably don't call lust, but which functions the same way in their thinking, of something which is not an action, but an orientation toward another person mm-hmm. that you sexually desire mm-hmm. that is wrong.
Right.
And like, I would be fascinated to hear, you know, how people articulate, for example, you know, are there forms of sexual fantasy which promote ideas of ownership mm-hmm. Over another person in ways that are, even if it never changes your behavior, right, still not things you want to encourage in yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think the reason to connect what is acceptable sex to procreation is that that's kind of a built-in structure, that if you're not willing to open yourself up to having children, then you're not in the right place where you should be doing something with the other person's body, doing something sexual with the other person's body. So biologically, everything is built to work properly. If you just put that male, female, they could have a child. They don't use birth control. They're accepting the consequences. It's all built into the system of heterosexual sex with people
right.
who are not too old to have a baby.
Right.
But you could extend from that. You could say, well, maybe that's sort of a core, that's good sexual love. But there are other things that are like that, too. So whatever you have, mm-hmm. you may be infertile. You may be too old to have a child. You may be attracted to people of the same sex, so there won't be a child for you, but you could still say that the love that you have is equivalent mm-hmm. to what the love of a couple that are open to having a child would mm-hmm. have. It would seem to me that you could
right.
extend the border just that far and that would be right. Even in
yeah,
a really super conservative position, such as you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, as I said before, I don't know that I can make a start to finish argument for the Catholic position on all counts. One thing I would point out, it's interesting that you're talking about sort of starting with, if you are that much in love with someone and desiring them sexually, you should want or be ready for, I guess, children with them, which I think is a very interesting way to...
I would think if you, mm-hmm. In a religious idea, that's the way we now know how to do birth control. We know how to do abortions. But in the original state, if you have sex, you're open to children. I mean, isn't that what the Catholic Church teaches?
Right. And I guess the thing that is so striking to me is that right now, so much of what needs to happen in our culture is actually the other way around. I mean, insofar, well, the change that you're talking about of sexual love should lead to children would be good. But at the same time, we also have, you know, tons of people who are very much ready to have a child with someone who they have no interest, intention, or mm-hmm. somewhat shaky interest or intention of marrying.
So
both things have been, it's been disconnected kind of in both directions.
Yeah, I agree that it's been disconnected in both directions. And that other direction that you just mentioned is really the more important direction, since people owe things to the children that they have, as opposed to things that they do temporarily that exclude children. Maybe we could, you know, that's their business. They can do whatever's good for them. I mean, I mainly am just promoting not having sex unless there's love, because I think that's what's good for people, and that people are pushed into or feel pulled into overactive sexuality that's not really making them happy and not really mm-hmm. doing them any good or doing anyone any good. But that's not a religious point. I just thought that you could mm-hmm. defend celibacy beyond the religious sphere more than that. Hey, I wanted to ask you, I know we're coming close to an hour, yes. and I wanted to ask you yes. About with this back to the Supreme Court. What do you think of the way it's come to pass that the Supreme Court will be all Catholic and Jewish justices? Why do you think that happened? Do you think it's a good or a bad thing? And do you think it's something that we shouldn't talk about?
I certainly do think it's an interesting thing to talk about. It's valid. I don't know to what extent it's hugely meaningful. I would say almost the bigger story in that is the decline of the mainline Protestant establishment. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that suddenly there are all these Jews and Catholics. It's more like, well, once the Protestant state has withered away, the Jews and Catholics kind of flow in to fill the gap.
You think the Protestant faith has withered away?
I said, oh, state. That was a Karl Marx joke. Sorry.
Oh, state. Okay. All right. Okay.
But, no, definitely not.
I mean, you were connecting Catholicism and Judaism yourself at the beginning mm-hmm. of the dialogue, where you're mm-hmm. saying there was something about the Jewish teachings and the culture of justice and so forth that was related to you, to being Catholic. And I wonder if there's something inherently legal about Catholics and Jews that somehow the Protestants have been that not having a Protestant on the court is really more meaningful than people are willing to talk about, that there's something missing if all of the minds that are doing the judging are in the Catholic and Jewish mode, that we're missing a diversity of mind that's important to interpretation, that it's more than just, oh, let's not talk about that. You know, that really isn't part of judging. Maybe it really is very much about how the mind works, and that that something about the filtering process of who goes through law, who gets into the position of being in the pool that gets selected, and who does get selected, that there has been something that has drawn us to the Catholic and Jewish candidates, and we really are missing something that needs to be there to have the best the sort of decision making that we ought to have.
Yeah, and you know, and I've read various speculation about, well, what are the features of Catholic or Jewish ways of life that make them especially amenable to the law? And none of them have been wildly persuasive to me, which is why I'm sort of resisting making this a big sort of statement about the law. But you'll certainly find people who will say, you know, one of the more fascinating ones that I read recently was, well, maybe Catholics are more drawn to the legal profession because they have not been inculcated in this idea that everyone interprets the Bible for himself. Right. So they're used to working with a pre-existing canon and sort of interpretive tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a lot of writing within jurisprudence about that, that there really is something mm-hmm. in the Protestant tradition, which is, okay, well, I'm just going to read the text and figure out what mm-hmm. it means. I can read the Sermon on the Mount, and I'll try to understand that, and I'll use my mind, and that is a Protestant tradition, and maybe you might think, well, it's better not to have that on the court, or that really is too naive to be a good way to think about law. But it is a part of the American culture that many people are Protestants, so it is a big part of the American tradition, and maybe it should be on the court. A lot of people don't like to talk about this and inherently resist or would think that I'm saying something that sounds very wrong, because I'm acting like there's a mind that is associated with each of the religious groups, and that mm-hmm. seems like it would foment bad sorts of discrimination, as opposed to being a way of thinking about diversity and collaborative thinking within a group like the court.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear. Well, for one thing, there's always going to be more than one kind or style of Catholicism that's even true when everyone involved is totally Orthodox, the way someone with a more Carmelite spirituality, you know, would approach the law is not going to look, I think, anything like someone who's more drawn to the natural law tradition. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but you're totally right that, you know, religion shapes culture. It shapes how people are and how people think. I'm still unconvinced that any of the specific explanations that I've seen are necessarily quite right. I mean, for example, even with the individual interpretation thing, I mean, you know, I've equally seen arguments that Jews are drawn to the law because they're used to reading the text themselves, and working very hard on interpretation and scholarship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it seems to me like you can explain the same if you can explain the same phenomenon with completely opposite reasons, both might be true. They're not directly in contradiction. But it still leaves me a bit skeptical as to whether we've figured this out yet, out why this has happened.
Now, and I assume some of them are just atheists. By the way, there was a poll, a Gallup poll, or I have it in my blog somewhere, but where they surveyed people about what kinds of people shouldn't be on the court at all.
Right.
And I think the only groups that got a majority were number one, socialists, number two, atheists, and number three, Muslims. So those were they weren't that much more than a majority, but as far as not appropriate on the court, those were the three groups that got more than a majority of Americans. So socialists were the least popular, but atheists were quite – there was a lot of opposition to atheists, and I just assume we've had many atheists on the court. It hasn't showed up, but obviously I don't think the president would pick someone who was open. You know, you can't be openly atheist and be on the court. But I assume that's happened many times. We're kind of up on an hour, but I thought there was one more thing we were going to talk about. If you wanted to say anything about that, or if you have to rush off, Leah. We wanted to say a little something about the way political figures speak in religious terms or use religion in the public sphere. There's been some talk about President Obama doing that. Mm-hmm, and some people think that the public sphere, where you're talking about actual government officials, that they shouldn't be speaking in terms of religion, that they should de-religionize their speech so that it's, a lingua franca and everyone can participate in it. That's exclusionary to bring religion into government official speech.
Yeah, and I mean, my basic position on this is pretty simple, right? I want whatever makes for good rhetoric. I actually really can't stand Barack Obama's style of rhetoric, but...
Yeah, what's the problem?
It's very abstracted to me. You know that line from Alice in Wonderland about her... I think it's her sister is reading a book with no pictures or conversations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, like, Obama's rhetoric feels very... lots and lots of abstract nouns, which are supposed to be very inspiring, but since I don't really know what is in those boxes that he's labeled hope or what have you, I feel left very cold by it.
Yeah. Anyway, generally in the electoral process, people liked the boxes labeled hope and change in the election, and they bought into it. He got elected. And now when they find out everything that he's doing, they don't seem to like any of it. We didn't know the specific
People never like, you know, what politicians actually do. I think people put a lot of – I think people were somewhat naive about what it takes to get to the position of being a credible candidate for president of the United States of America in 2008. Mm-hmm. I think they assumed that you could get to that position in life while still being pure in heart. I am not a huge fan of pure in heart in general, but – especially, I think it's ridiculous to expect that of a successful politician. I just don't know where people were even coming from on that. But in terms of sort of religious rhetoric, I have no problem with it if it makes your speeches better. You will never be able to give a good speech that is actually lingua franca for the entire American people. Mm-hmm. So I would just focus on making the most powerful and most sort of aesthetically compelling case that you can. And if that means you talk about Jesus a lot, well, you know, God bless you. If it means that you talk, if it means that you never do and really keep that entirely out of your public presentation, that's like, I'm A-okay with that too.
Well, I think it tends to be a kind of inherently, a generalized religion or something, I guess in law we refer to ceremonial deism, you know, that there's an, it mm-hmm. becomes this religion that's actually not very religion-y. If government is going to appropriate religion for its governmental purposes, it's going to be a pretty denatured kind of a religion that isn't going to be worth much. It's going to take something away from religion. Now, of course, some people like that. Some people love, you know, let's make religion less religion, and let's have a state allied with religion so that religion won't be so dangerous and different. And let's use it in government in that way. And it becomes very abstract and meaningless.
Right. I mean, I'm now picturing, you know, Dorothy Day or St. Francis giving a campaign speech.
Yeah, that wouldn't work, would it?
So what is your basic position on this? Do you have a settled position?
I think it's good for religion and government to be different. I think religion is bad mm-hmm. for government, and government is bad for religion, and that maintaining the separation is worth a lot, that people who value religion should also value keeping government out of it, and that keeping government out of religion and religion out of government isn't just for people who don't value religion. It should be, and perhaps especially be for people who value it, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I question to what extent that's possible, and certainly in terms of speech making, to what extent it's a good aesthetic choice. I totally hear you about the kind of mealy-mouthed ceremonial civic deism. I mean, no one's rhetoric is actually improved by tacking God Bless America on the end of their speeches. But in terms of sort of figuring out how to think about politics, you know, everyone has some bedrock loyalty or love that is driving their philosophy and their politics as well. And for religious people, that's often going to be their religion. And I kind of don't think there's any real way around it. In any country where most people are religious, politics is going to have a religious character, more or less, I think, because of the nature of political philosophy than any specific choice of rhetoric. At some point, you will get down to disagreements that aren't sort of technocratic, like how can we, you know, build a better interstate highway system, but about basic clashes of what does justice require, what do we owe one another, mm-hmm. Things like that.
I guess some people think that you can take a step away from religion and put it into mm-hmm. more generally philosophical terms or in terms of principles and values. And you don't have to imbue it with the religion. You can leave the religion mm-hmm. behind and restate it in a way. I mean, one of the problems I have with that requirement, and I don't really go that far, so I'm not super fastidious about not having any references to God. I don't like too much of it. I don't like when it's not believable. But I think that if you're too fastidious about sanitizing religion out of politics, you're making it too hard for some people to speak, and you're kind of creating an elite public debate where some people don't know how to speak properly about it. I don't even understand that. I don't know how to talk like that. So I think you're disenfranchising some people. You're excluding some people from the debate. So that's why I wouldn't go too far in that direction.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think I think my personal ideal sort of state of religion in the public square would be that for every hot button issue, there are people who are able to make both religiously based and more secular / natural law cases. There will be and people, like, ideally, you know, we would be able to explain things to one another across major barriers of religious belief and unbelief, but at the same time, because ultimately, right, like what I think about the prison system, right, is in many ways coming from my Christianity, even though, you know, I can also, I would assume, talk to an atheist about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of want both, I guess.
But there are some things that I guess you would exclude them from being the subject of public policy about which your mm-hmm. position is purely religious, and you don't even attempt to make an argument outside of religion about it.
Right, and I agree with you. Those are things that I would not have in public policy debate.
So as far as same-sex marriage, we could close, but as far as government policy, as far as whether there should be a legal ability of same-sex persons to marry, you might be willing to say yes to that, even though from a religious perspective, you would say no.
Well, no, I wouldn't. I mean, when I've written about gay marriage, I have attempted to make the case in secular terms, which is the way it was made to me. Basically just picking up on, because men and women are different, heterosexual relationships are going to require different structures and controls than homosexual relationships. I think you can make that case without bringing religion into it. You can at least, you can make it with a lot of people who already buy that men and women are different, that they're differently situated, and that both biology and culture sort of work together to create that difference. But, right, if I thought that the only valid case against gay marriage was a purely, you know, God says, God said it, I believe it, that settles it, mm-hmm. then yeah, I would not want that to be an object of public policy.
Okay, well, there's a lot more that could be said about that, but having gone a little over an hour, I'm going to, I'm not going to respond to that, but I'll say I do support legalizing gay marriage. I think that that would be good, but I'm not going to, we can't
talk
forever.
I should probably say that I do support legal recognition of gay couples. Yeah. I think preserving marriage as a specific thing is
There's so many financial things that have to do with it, taxing and health insurance and all of this, that I just think it's not fair to I just think all the other ideas are way too abstract to limit what benefits people get.
Oh, right, right. In terms of sort of provision of specific benefits, I have no problem. I support some form of civil unions or domestic partnerships. I just think it's worth having a culture and vocabulary, including legal vocabulary, that can talk about the differences between these kinds of relationships as well as the obvious similarities.
Okay, well, I'm going to let you go because we can't go on too long. But
yes,
it was great talking.
Okay, well, this was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.